Hello, I'm Katrina Fox. Since recording this podcast, you can now find a lot of my content for vegan businesses, including my Vegans in the Limelight PR course, as part of veganbusinesstribe.com. If you're a vegan leader of any kind and want to connect with me directly to help you use strategic storytelling to ethically influence your audience, then please visit katrinafox.com. I hope you enjoy the show.
Are you a vegan who views your business as your form of activism? If so, Vegan Business Tribe has hundreds of hours of masterclasses, courses, guides, and podcasts to help you grow a vegan business that doesn't just make a profit, but makes an impact too. Just head over to veganbusinesstribe.com and also claim a free 20-minute coaching call when you sign up.
Welcome to Vegan Business Talk with Katrina Fox, author of Vegan Ventures, Start and Grow an Ethical Business. Hello and welcome to episode 122 of Vegan Business Talk. I'm Katrina Fox, journalist, author and PR consultant and founder of Vegan Business Media, a content events and training platform providing success strategies for vegan business owners and entrepreneurs. Now, just quickly, before we jump into the main part of the show, I wanted to let you know about my online PR course and group coaching program, Vegans in the Limelight. Now, this is a 12-month online program where you have video training that teaches you everything you need to know about how to do your own PR. You can ask questions on the platform and you can also post your proposed pitches and media releases before sending them to journalists to get my feedback. You also get to jump on a monthly live group call where you can ask whatever questions you want about your business and you can get tailored help from me on anything to do with raising the profile of your brand. So it might be that I look at your website and give you some feedback or how to improve your LinkedIn profile and other marketing and PR topics. So if you'd like to find out more about that, just hop on over to veganbusinessmedia.com and you'll see a link there for Vegans in the Limelight. And now on to the main part of the show. In this episode, which was recorded live in person in New York at the inaugural Plant-Based World Conference and Expo, I interview Michael Schwartz, founder of Treeline Tree Nut Cheese in upstate New York. Michael's discovery of the cruelty involved in dairy production and the harm animal agriculture causes to the environment were key drivers for his decision to give up not just milk, but his entire career as an intellectual property attorney and focus on vegan cheese making. Raised in South Africa, Michael inherited his activism from his parents. His father, Harry Schwartz, was a key figure in the fight to end apartheid and a longtime friend and colleague of Nelson Mandela. Michael moved to the US in the 1980s at the height of apartheid's power, went to law school, and for over 25 years practiced IP law in Dallas, London, New York, and Washington. In 2012, he began to experiment with fermenting cashew nuts, culminating in the launch of Treeline, which is now a national brand available in grocery and specialty stores across the US, including Whole Foods, Kroger, and many independent health food stores and small chains. In this interview, Michael talks about how he got his first distributor and retailer, a process that involved losing a lot of money but was necessary, why learning to say no if you don't have the capacity or finances to fulfill orders is better for your brand in the long run, how a negative experience at trial during his lawyer days is the reason why Treeline has never failed to fulfill an order to date, why the company doesn't use dairy cheese names such as Brie or Camembert for its products, and much more. Here's the interview with Michael Schwartz from Treeline Tree Nut Cheese. So, Michael, tell me about the why, the background of why you do what you do. It's a question I ask everyone when I interview them for the show, and I love hearing about people's journeys. And you've got a particularly interesting journey because I know you're a former IP lawyer and you have a degree in engineering, and you now make this amazing vegan cheese. So I'm interested about your why, and tell us a little about your journey of how you got here.
I started the company because I felt very strongly about the plight of dairy cows and goats and sheep. I think dairy is one of the most cruel foods that human beings have managed to produce. I was a vegetarian for many years, and I was in denial of dairy because I thought, well, you're not eating the animals, so it's okay. And then when I started finding out more information about just how dairy is produced, I became very disturbed and felt that I had to give it up, number one. And then I really, like many other people, liked cheese. I traveled a lot in Europe for work as an intellectual property lawyer, used to meet clients and have amazing French and Italian cheeses. I missed those when I gave up dairy. And I then put two and two together and saw that there was a gap in the market for that type of high-quality cheese. So that's really the why.
It's interesting, actually, I can relate to a lot of what you said. I was vegetarian since I was 11, but it took me a long time to get to vegan because, you know, we buy the whole image of the happy cows and you think, oh, the cow isn't dying.
Right.
So I can definitely relate to that. And my partner had a house in the south of France, so we used to go to France and, again, love the cheese. And when I went vegan 22 years ago, the vegan cheese has tasted like rubber. It's really fun. I love the fact there's all these amazing new vegan cheeses coming out now. So it's interesting, you've literally had such a big change of career, though, from an IP lawyer to making cheese in your kitchen, essentially, to then growing it into this global brand. So one might say, well, you could have used your skills as an IP lawyer to still help animals. So I'm just curious about how you got into making the cheese. It's such a, I'm going to make a pun now, a tree change. How did that kind of come about?
I don't really know. I had decided that I didn't really want to practice law. I just kind of ran out of steam, and I was looking around for something interesting to do that would make me feel good about my daily work. I started a company with a client and friend of mine, which was not a food company, and that we had success in a very short time. That gave me some breathing space to look around, and I just saw that gap in the market, so
yeah.
I decided to do it. But I don't know, I don't think there was any kind of thought process that led me to it besides there's a gap in the market, I'm vegan, I like cheese, why don't I try?
Got it, I love it. So, and I imagine your skills from your previous profession must have been helpful as a lawyer, especially in terms of IP, would that be right?
Not especially. I think my engineering background helped a lot because it forced me into a kind of a discipline in the development process, and it's also helped me with designing the plant, with understanding how our equipment works and debugging equipment. I think the engineering, strange enough, has been more useful than the law.
Really? What about with contracts and things?
That's an interesting question because when you're a startup, you don't really get to negotiate contracts.
Right,
you just do
enough.
What you're told.
Fair point. We'll get on to that, actually, because that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. But let's just go back a bit. So when you were first starting out, what were some of your key challenges and how did you overcome them?
I think the most difficult thing for a food startup is to get some sort of critical mass in retail so that you can then convince distributors to take your product. And that's a real chicken and egg problem because they don't want you until you've got critical mass. and you can't get the critical mass without them.
Yeah.
So that, I think that was probably the biggest challenge.
And how did you handle that? So how did you go from, because I think this is interesting for anyone who's starting up a plant-based product of any kind, to go from that kind of artisanal, you know, in your home kind of thing, to growing it as you have and getting into those big chains. Tell us a bit about that process. What did it entail, and okay, how did
so
you go about
you
it?
You get yourself a cooler with some cold packs and wheels on it. And you get yourself some comfortable shoes and you start walking around New York City trying to convince stores that they should take your product.
Wow. Wow. So you literally kind of did that physically on foot. You went to the big...
I did. Not the big ones, the small ones.
Small
the big ones,
ones
weren't
right.
Interested yet. And then my sales guy literally did the same thing in the Catskill region in Chicago, and just went from door to door and eventually
made appointments beforehand with like the buyers.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Really? Okay.
We also did a lot of cold calling. We shipped products by UPS to stores, lost enormous amounts of money doing that.
Really?
But that's what we had to do to make it happen.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So you literally kind of, you went, did the whole thing, the door to door. So you started at, what I wrote right in thinking, you start out with the smaller places, and then once the smaller places start to take you, then the bigger places start to take notice of you. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's how it works. And I must say that Whole Foods helped a lot, because Whole Foods has a program for local producers,
yeah,
and they are open to taking products that are not known because they are local. And I don't know if they still do it. I think they do, but that really helped an awful lot.
Yeah.
Because a larger chain, you know, like a Publix or Albertsons, just they don't really do that, and or at least to my knowledge, they don't.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the keynote talk at this event this morning, one of the retailers, I think it was the woman from Kroger, was saying that obviously shelf space is finite, being a physical retail store, and one of the issues for them as retailers is when small brands come on board and their product is popular, which obviously you want because it sells out, but then they haven't got the capacity to keep filling those orders, and then suddenly there's a period where they're out of stock, and that's not good for the retailer or the customers. How did you handle it, or how do you recommend that businesses handle that? Because like you said, going from just, you know, producing enough for maybe farmers markets to producing enough to regularly be on the shelves of supermarkets. Can you talk us through that a little bit, about what's entailed?
I think that really is a big issue. It has not been an issue for my company, and this is something I feel very proud of. We have never failed to fill a purchase order, and we will do it. Failure is not an option for us, and that's because I've got a good team. I have an excellent general manager who also takes great pride in getting the job done every single week. Now, I think all I can say to startups like us is don't bite off more than you can chew, because you'll end up with nothing. And you know, if you find that you get an opportunity, you've got to look at that opportunity and work out if you can in fact deliver, and also that in terms of your capacity, and also can you finance that, because you're not going to get paid for quite some time.
I was going to ask you
and
about that. Yeah.
So you've got to be very careful about it. Now I'm lucky, but you know, Larry Bird, the great basketball player, said the better you are, the better luck you have. And, you know, it's not just by accident that we are so reliable. It's by design, and it's a very important part of our business.
How did you put that in place? You've mentioned team, so did you get your team on quite early in your company? Because I know it's like taking on staff as you grow, obviously they're a key expense. So tell us a little bit about how you grew your team.
You know, there was no real magic to it. I lucked on some really good people, and I think they are highly motivated, they are good at their jobs, and I also just have an attitude that I don't handle failure very well, and I just don't, I don't, I really, really don't like losing. I hate losing. As a lawyer, I once walked out of a hearing where I lost on every issue, and I was walking out of the courthouse in downtown New York, and I just felt so horrible. And then I stopped and I said, "You're meant to feel horrible. If you like losing, you're a loser. Don't become that person." And I said, "It's okay. Feel horrible. Just feel bad about this whole incident." And I think that's important.
That's, in terms of them, what team members did you bring on first?
The first people in our new manufacturing facility. The first guy was someone I brought in as a salesperson, and he then moved on to being operations. But I did the manufacturing myself physically, and I had hourly workers helping me. But I was actually, I've done every job in the factory, including mopping the floor. I mean, that's what you got to do.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were just talking earlier before we did this interview about the Fry family, because you're both all from South Africa, and Wally Fry, who's the founder of Fry, said pretty much the same thing. Did all those different jobs so that you appreciate what goes on. That's great. In terms of the retailers then, what are some of the challenges there? You mentioned one of them in that you don't get paid straight away. What are some of the other challenges involved that perhaps, you know, artisanal startups, you know, they might not realise? What are some of the things you need to take into account when working with distributors and retailers?
Well, I think the first thing is you've got to kind of get over yourself, in the sense that a lot of small food manufacturers think they've got something fantastic and that the whole world's waiting for it. That is not the case. Okay, no one's really waiting for your product. You've got to convince them to buy it. Then you've also got to realize that you fit into a context, and the context is something you mentioned, that there's limited space and not everybody can be in the store, and if you don't produce results, you will be dropped.
Yeah.
A challenge is that the food business is very much a legacy business, and it's not, in the retail and distribution side, it's not that open to innovation. Because if you're selling something and you're doing okay on it, why would you change that? And it's quite hard to convince very conservative people in that industry to take a chance on a new way of doing things. And vegan cheese really is a new way of doing things. Yeah. People have been making dairy cheese for as long as anyone can remember.
Yeah.
And it's so ingrained into our culture. And to get a guy whose life has been buying dairy cheese and putting it on the shelf to suddenly say, "Well, let me try something that's completely different, that has no record of sales, because this guy thinks that he can sell us." That's difficult.
Yeah, yeah, you can imagine. And in terms of creating the demand, I guess it's sounding like you, as a brand, have to do your own marketing and promotion so that people know about it, so that they will then go into the stores and buy your product. So you can't rely on the supermarkets or the retailers to do the promotion or marketing for you, is
that's
that right?
Completely correct.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. No, that's great. So on that then, what have been some of the marketing or promotional strategies that you've used to date that have been the most effective?
Well, there's an old kind of story of a department store owner in New York who said, "Half of all my advertising money is wasted. I just don't know which half."
Right? I've heard that, yeah.
And so that's true of any efforts you make. Yeah. So one of the things I've done a lot of is promoting the product through vegan festivals.
Yeah.
And my thinking on that is that someone who goes to a vegan festival is typically a new vegan who's looking for new products. And if we can offer our products at those festivals, that's the exact audience that we want. If we do a demo in a store, 95% of the people who are in that store are not interested in our product. Whereas if we go to a veg
fest,
even
if you do taste testings,
even with taste testing, because they're not vegans and they are looking for their usual products that they know. And they will often taste the product, they'll even buy it, but that doesn't mean they'll buy it a second
again,
time.
Right.
And you're also spending, 100% of your money going after maybe 5%, whereas with a veg fest, it's 100%, right? So that's, I think, a very powerful way of
physical marketing, you think it's been?
Actually setting up a table, sampling the cheese, giving coupons, and then we also try to track the coupons so we can see where they've been redeemed.
Got it.
And that way we know if that was effective. And then we do the usual social media. We do a lot of work which sort of does two things at the same time. One, I like to give to charities that help animals. And two, I like to market the product. So we do a lot of work with, for example, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We sponsored a podcast for them. We serve our cheese at their fundraisers. Best Friends Animal Society, we serve at their fundraisers. Farm Sanctuary, we just sponsor. Last year, and the year before, we sponsored two calves where we matched donations to help those calves. This year we're going to do something similar.
Right, and all creates the word of mouth.
Right.
So,
And those are our people, and it also makes me happy that money from Treeline is going to those charities.
So am I right in thinking, I was going to ask you about your predominant audience demographic. Are you basically more or less aiming at vegans? Are they your predominant customer?
Yes, the vegans are the predominant customer. However, we don't think that we can grow the business as big as we'd like to if we exclusively have a vegan following. So we are trying to expand to so-called flexitarians.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the people we most want are the vegans, because those are the people who most want us.
What about the allergy department? Like dairy, people who've got allergy to dairy, are they another market for
definitely
you?
Paleo is a big market for us. But I think that our real core, our base is vegans, and that will be like that for a while. And it's really not a bad thing, because there are very few customer bases where new customers are being made every day.
Yeah.
And there are new vegans every single day. As more and more information comes out on the benefits of veganism for you, for the planet, for animals, more and more people are doing it. So we're focusing on a vegan base, but that base is growing.
Got it.
And, you know, there's no growing base for granola bars.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same people who are buying the... Suddenly you don't wake up and go, I think I'll eat granola bars today.
Yeah, it's true. So I'm guessing then, because another question I typically ask vegan entrepreneurs is the use of the word vegan in your branding and marketing. You know, some say, oh no, it's better to use plant-based or nothing at all. I'm assuming that you're quite happy to use vegan on your branding and marketing.
I'm perfectly happy to use it. I years ago I went to a talk by a guy named A.M. Rosenthal, who was the publisher of the New York Times. And when he joined the New York Times, probably in the 1950s, his boss said to him, his name was Abe Rosenthal, don't use the word Abe, call yourself A.M. Abe is too Jewish. Okay. And that struck me. And I know I'm Jewish, and I don't want to apologize for what I am.
Yeah.
And I'm not apologizing for being vegan.
Nice.
So I am perfectly happy to use it, and I was told not to by a lot of very smart people, and I refused. And I think today the word vegan is coming to connote quality and a product that someone can rely on as being a good product that does good things.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think it's going to be a mark of quality rather than some sort of dirty word that people think have thought it is.
Got it. We are seeing a lot of new players in the market, like the vegan cheese category is exploding. You know, I was in Switzerland back in January. I tasted like a vegan version of brie or camembert. I never thought I would have that taste again. So it's really developing. How do you continue to make Treeline stand apart?
in the face of so-called competition. I put competition in quotes because in many ways the rising tide, you know, lifts all boats and helps the category. But how do you, stay apart, stand apart to keep your customers?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we stick to a very clean label. Our products have very few ingredients, and we don't add any coconut oil or gums or thickeners or anything like that. That we distinguish ourselves on the basis of being a very, very pure product, and that's most reflected in our latest new product, which is a cream cheese, which I call premium New York style cream cheese.
Have you got samples out there?
I have.
I should be going to try some.
It's really good.
It's sounding nice. Even just you describing me, I'm thinking that sounds nice.
And it tastes amazing, and it has very few ingredients. So that's what distinguishes us. I think ultimately more and more companies will do what we're doing. Another thing we are avoiding is we're avoiding trying to call our products by familiar cheese names. So we're not trying to say this is Brie or this is Gruyere. We're just saying this is cheese made of cashew nuts.
Right.
So that the non-vegans won't say, well, that clearly isn't Brie. I know Brie, and it clearly isn't Brie. And I've seen this in France. If you say to a Frenchman, this stuff is Brie, he just laughs at you and says, that's ridiculous. But if you say, why don't you try a new kind of cheese that's fermented cashew nuts? Yeah. He goes, yeah, that's interesting.
Okay. Interesting. Oh, that's interesting. Cool. So just finally, final couple of questions. One is, what would you say have been the key lessons that you've learned, and any advice you might offer to upcoming entrepreneurs?
That's a difficult question to answer because there are so many lessons. And bear in mind, I did not come from a food background. And I think one important lesson is that if you're starting a company in the food business and you don't have experience in the food business, you probably should find someone to just sit down with and just find out about the business, because it is a very unique business with its own way of doing things, and you can avoid a lot of frustration if you really have a good understanding of it to begin with. And then I would say you've got to really maintain discipline and make sure that you don't get sidetracked with new products, with new opportunities. You've got to evaluate them all very coldly and calculatedly to make sure that they don't distract you and they are going to make money for you.
Yeah,
and a good example on this is you may get a store that wants to carry the product and you want to make a sale, but then you go and look at the store and you go, the people aren't really buying this product in the store. This is the wrong demographic. You've got to be able to say no and say, I'll come to that. Maybe in a few years' time I'll come to that, but that's not right for us now.
That's really good advice. It could be tempting, exciting, almost flattering when someone comes to you. That's really good advice. One thing I forgot to ask you, as much as you're comfortable sharing, how's the company been funded to date?
It's been funded by me, and I would say that if you start this type of company, whatever you think you're going to spend, you're going to spend a lot.
Yes,
more.
So many entrepreneurs have said the same thing. Whatever budget you set, you want to. I've heard people say times it by five. I've even heard people say times it by 10 in some cases, which sounds horrendous. No, that's great advice. So just finally, then, what's the future for Treeline? For yourself and for Treeline?
Well, for myself, I hope it's the south of France and some good food.
Introducing
and wine.
Them to vegan cheese.
But for the company, I mean, we're going to grow very significantly in the next few years. I think we're going to cross over into the mainstream because we're riding on the crest of this plant-based wave, and more and more people are open to plant-based foods. So I see a tremendous growth in the next 3 or 4 years.
Would you, because we're seeing now some of the companies like Beyond Meat, for example, go public. I think Impossible are considering, or some others are considering. Is that something, when you say you're going to expand considerably, is that how you see yourself expanding with investment?
Investment, but not, we're not going to go public for quite some time. Right. I mean, I think that's a long way off, but definitely we'll be taking in investments and from strategic investors, and we're moving into a new phase of growth from just being a fairly small company to being a really important company in vegan cheese and possibly other dairy substitutes.
Wonderful. Fantastic. Thank you so much for talking with me, Michael. It's been great, and I'm going to look forward to going and try one or more of the samples. But thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
So that was Michael Schwartz from Treeline Tree Nut Cheese. You can find out more at treelinecheese.com. And that link is on the show notes page at veganbusinessmedia.com/podcasts and going to episode 122. Now for some vegan business news highlights. Next generation vegan meat products are starting to take off in Australia. The Alternative Meat Company recently launched its new range of vegan burgers, sausages and mince, all of which are available in the chilled meat section of major supermarket chains. Now, I went to the VIP launch of the products, even though I'm not their market, because like Beyond Meat, they're aiming at people who currently eat meat and want something that tastes, smells, feels and cooks the same as animal-based proteins. But I spoke to several people at the event, including some mainstream media journalists, all of whom said they loved the products. One even said that she wouldn't have been able to tell the difference in a taste test. Meanwhile, Hungry Jack's fast food chain has teamed up with Federal Government Science and Research Agency CSIRO to create a vegan version of the chain's classic Whopper. Hungry Jack's founder, Jack Cowan, said the company is doing this in response to people's desire to eat in a more planet-friendly way. It's fantastic to see these kinds of products spreading across the globe. A vegan hotel is set to open in Scotland this month. That's June 2019, if you're listening in the future, reports Plant-Based News. Seorsa 1875 in Pitlochry is the brainchild of two vegans. Everything in the hotel is animal-free, including bedding, toiletries and cleaning products. And the electricity is supplied by Vegan Society certified Ecotricity. Italian chef Luca Sordi is in charge of the kitchen, and he'll use ingredients either sourced from the hotel's vegetable patch or independent local suppliers. The hotel will also collaborate with top vegan chefs from around the UK to create one-off dining experiences. So this is exciting, and we're starting to see a trend in hotels recognising that consumers are looking for places to stay that are cruelty-free as well as environmentally friendly. In a previous episode, you may remember I reported on the Hilton Bankside in London creating a vegan suite, and I anticipate we'll see more accommodation businesses follow suit. Fantastic. So that's it for this episode of Vegan Business Talk. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, I'd really appreciate it if you gave it a review and rating on iTunes or any other platform you're listening on. Finally, I encourage you to head over to veganbusinessmedia.com, where you can find more free resources as well as details of how we can work together to help you grow your vegan business. I'm Katrina Fox, author of Vegan Ventures: Start and Grow an Ethical Business, and I look forward to catching up with you in the next episode of Vegan Business Talk. Bye for now.
If you enjoyed this podcast, also check out the Vegan Business Tribe podcast with myself, David Pennell. And you can find that on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as the video version on YouTube too. And if you want to be part of the most amazing community of vegan business owners from around the world, then come and sign up with us at veganbusinesstribe.com to get all the support you need to grow a successful vegan business.